We're going to get started real quickly here. I do have some important announcements I'll do real quickly, and we'll turn the time over to the panel in just a minute. If there's anyone here right now or knows of friends who are coming this evening to hear just the speaker and not having the dinner, we'll have a stack of chairs out right outside the door that they can get one, and we'll be sitting around the walls because the whole double room here will be full of the dinner tables, and I'll announce that again this afternoon. Reminder again that all those who are interested in website creation and in linking our websites and getting a little more coordinated in what you're going to do and sharing ideas with each other, there will be a meeting at 12:30 in this room for anyone interested in that. And I don't know how many of you noticed, and I forgot to announce this last night, Signature Books is here with an extensive book table, and they're right outside the hospitality room. He'll be here all day until about 6 o'clock tonight, so be sure and take a look at those. He's got some great books out there. And we have two people who have presented before at our conferences who have brought books to sell. Dwayne Anderson, and both those books, sets of books will be on this table up here, and they will be selling their books directly. And Art Vanek is the other one with the book about the Book of Mormon. So you can take a look at those books on this table. Anyone who has purchased a full conference, including dinner, and has found out they can't be here for the dinner, we would appreciate it if you would turn the tickets in to the registration people so that we can have an accurate count for we get charged per dinner, and that will help us a lot if by any chance you aren't able to make it to the dinner. Also, I'd like to announce that Steve Hassan has donated one each of his books that he's written, which he will sign, and they will be part of our raffle tonight. And I've put them on the table for you to look at. And then Chad Hardy has brought several boxes of T-shirts that they ordered, which didn't come in the right colors and stuff. And he's got several boxes out there, and they are free. He's going to lay them, and he's got all kinds of sizes. Mormons Exposed with the sex highlighted.
As if they had any.
And this one, I heart Mormon Boys, which I don't get. Somebody explain it to me. Anyway, they will be right outside the door on the table that's by the bar for the bulk of the day today until it has to be cleared off. So you can take as many as you want. He said, I've got tons. I thought that was great for him to bring them. So you can take as many as you want. Make sure I got everything here. And the raffle tickets will be sold all day. Are the two gentlemen selling them in here yet? All right. Well, anyway, they will be selling them all day and all during dinner. And after the dinner speaker is finished, we will be doing our door prizes and our raffle. We've really got some good stuff, great stuff this year. Okay, I'm going to turn the time over to Tom, who is going to do a little moderating for our panel. Oh, I also forgot. The calendars are here. So there will be several of the 2008 version, which will be door prizes. There'll be several of the new issue, which will be part of the raffle. And then we will also have others to sell at a much discounted price from what, because Chad has donated them to the foundation. So they'll be $9.99, the ones that are sold. They usually sell for $15.99. Thanks.
I do want to mention one thing. This is the sound guy. We have a video camera up here on the right-hand side, so that means if you have concerns about showing up on video, you probably don't want to be right near the front of the room. We will not be panning back any further than, say, the third row or so, but just be aware of that.
Morning. It's nice to see all your bleary-eyed, bloodshot, terrestrial beauty. Sue asked me to moderate this. I said, if it really goes bad, you're going to hear Johnny Carson impersonations, so let's hope it goes well. And we We have to be on time, so I'm going to be referring to my brand new cell phone. At 10:30, we need to wrap it up. So I jotted down some questions I had. We're going to reserve them for later, but we're going to take, let's say, maybe approximately 15 to 20 minutes per couple. Introduce yourselves, tell us exit stories, different feelings you had on the way. And as a result, we may get more questions from that information. We know that, fortunately, some people do come out together. Sometimes it takes a little time. And some don't come out at all. You get one spouse out, one spouse still in, maybe for life. And as we analyze those dimensions, maybe we can come up with some working, you know, tools to help out those who haven't yet. So go ahead and take some time. We have two microphones. If you want to take the mobile one and pass it along, go ahead and get started. And just tell us your names and about yourself.
You give the whole story first?
Yeah,
and then
take
we can
maybe 15, 20 minutes. Tell us about your history. Maybe who came out first. What issues you might have dealt with. I'm going to try to choreograph it all as we go. So I'll give you some kind of gyration.
All right. Well, my name is Grant Kimball. I've been out of the church for about 8 years. Just so there's no confusion here, there was another Grant Kimball that was scheduled to speak. And I saw that his name got taken off the list, and I said, well, why? I kind of wanted to meet the guy. So he couldn't make it for a business trip, so my wife and I volunteered to come out and talk about our experience. So for me and for my wife, we were both one of 8 kids in our respective families. My dad's a patriarch. I think my father-in-law was a bishop at one time. You know, very hardcore into the church our whole lives. But for me, when I grew up, I was very, very skeptical. I was the kid that never believed in Santa Claus. I always kept it to myself. But I remember, you know, my little logical, kind of nerdy mind, 5, 6 years old, I asked my mom where the golden plates were. Because up to that point, it hadn't occurred to me the church didn't have them. And when she told me the angel took him back, I was stunned. It sounded to me like the dog ate my homework excuse. I just buried it down. I was very insecure. I kept most of my feelings to myself and my thoughts to myself, and I just assumed I was wrong. And I went that way my whole life. At 12 years of age, I remember looking at the Abraham, the Book of Abraham, and seeing those drawings there and thinking, well, what do Egyptologists have to say about this? And I was told I shouldn't ask those kinds of questions and those will be answered later. So it just kind of kept going like that, and I kept that cognitive dissonance in the back of my mind, and I kept it back there very well. I was a good missionary. I went to Germany. My companions and I baptized 11 people in Germany. You know, I did everything I was supposed to do, and then, you know, we got married one day, and I was on a business trip one time, and a friend of mine mentioned to me that he had left the church. I asked him why, and he says, because I don't believe the Book of Mormon. And it was the definition of an epiphany for me. I thought about it for 4 or 5 seconds tops, and I go, I don't either. and that was my beginning of my exit out of the church. But at that point, I knew I had a real big problem because Brenda still very much believed in it. And she came from a family where her dad thought dinosaurs were a satanic plot. So I knew I had my work cut out for me. And so, I don't know, you know, Brendan and I have gone back and forth as to exactly what I did and whether or not I planned it. But I just knew instinctively that I had to get her to stop feeling guilty about things. I'm going to read you a little paragraph I wrote up about guilt and fear, the twin towers of religious belief. You take away guilt and fear, and you've got the job done. So a guilty, fearful person is a subservient person and much more easily controlled. That's why I believe religions have so many absurd and trivial rules covering everything from sex to the foods you eat to how often you pray and what clothes you wear. Without these rules, there is no guilt or fear and therefore no control. No one, not even the most pious follower, can keep all the rules. The church knows this and does its best to magnify the guilt you feel through institutions like confession, tithing settlement, and testimony meeting. Once the guilt and fear set in, then you are controllable or teachable, as the church would call it. So I instinctively knew that I had to get her to stop feeling guilty. I had to get her to start questioning, to start thinking rationally about different things. And I don't want to make it sound like you know, Brenda was a project. It wasn't that big of a deal. I just knew these things had to be addressed and had to be taken care of, and so I started doing specific things. One of the things I did was I started mocking her guilt. Every time she felt guilty about something, I would just jump on the bandwagon and say, yeah, you know, that was just an absolutely horrible thing that you did. You should not have done that. I'm gonna, I would just take it to the nth degree until she started laughing about it and see the absurdity of what she was talking about. Like she wouldn't do her visiting teaching. Occasionally, she was very good at this. So I just wrote one thing up here where she didn't visit Sister Williams, didn't do her visiting teaching to Sister Williams. I would go,
this is apocryphal.
This is apocryphal, but you'll get the right idea. You didn't visit teach Sister Williams? I heard her husband has walked out on her and her kids are all doing drugs. She's really depressed. I bet your visit might have pulled her out of the emotional downward spiral she's been in lately. In fact, I saw a police car at her house last night. So I would keep doing this until she'd start laughing and see the absurdity of the guilt that she was feeling, and then she'd be able to put it a little bit more into perspective. Another thing I did is obviously you can't do everything the church asks you to do. So I said, look, we've got to prioritize. We can't go to the temple every week or every month. We can't do everything the church is asking us, from the garden to giving a full tithe on our gross income. We can't do everything, and so we need to prioritize. When you've got little kids, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense that you're sitting there in sacrament meeting while they're all screaming. So we got to take them out. I'd keep doing all this, and she'd get angry at first, but eventually she'd start seeing the logic of what I was telling her, and she'd go, well, yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. It doesn't make sense that the kids are in there screaming, let's take them outside. It doesn't make sense that we pay gross on our tithing because, you know, if you're paying Social Security now and you're going to be getting that back later, you know, maybe we don't need to do all that. We still did, but, anyway. Yeah, anyway, but I kept doing things like that. And also Brenda was very, timid. She rarely spoke out and said what she really felt when she got mad. And so I started up this, I called it the De-Wussification of Brenda Project. So when one of our neighbors kept dumping her kids off on us without asking us if we could babysit them, you know, I kept saying, well, Brenda, why do you let her do that? And she goes, well, I don't know why I let her do that. Finally, one day she went down and had it out with her. And I go, Brenda, way to go, way to go. I was so proud of her. Anyway, so this kept going along, and I kept doing this for a couple years. I knew that if I didn't handle this correctly, then if I dumped everything on her at once, all my non-belief on her at once, I could lose my wife and kids. And it wasn't worth it to me. I know last night there was a lot of talk about courage and being open with your believing spouse, but I knew that if I didn't handle that right, I'd lose my wife and kids, and it's not worth it to me. So I made the conscious decision that I would go the rest of my life living a lie if I had to keep my family together. But I didn't go quietly. I kept working on her, and after 2 years, one morning she came in and said, I'm not sure I have a testimony. And I'm in sales, and I know one of the worst things you could do is act real excited when you've got the sale right there. And I go, you know, I've had a few doubts too. And but inside I'm going, yeah. So 2 months later, we're all out of the church, my wife and three kids, and life's been great ever since. Now, I wanted to... I wanted to leave most of the time with Brenda so she could give you her perspective on how this really worked, but anyway.
How much time do I have?
How much time is there?
Okay. Well, I'm not quite sure what to say. I think I should start back at the beginning. Can you hear me good enough? You know, I was raised in a very strict Mormon home, and one of the lessons I learned early in life was honesty. My parents just were very honest people, and they truly believed in the church. And when I was a young child, maybe 5 or 6, I got up to the podium at sacrament meeting and started saying what other people were saying and kind of doing a travelogue thing. And my dad was the bishop at the time. I guess he eventually pulled me down on his lap and said, you know, and made it clear, hey, you know, you don't get up here in testimony meeting and ramble on like that. You know, you need to be sincere and mean what you're saying, that sort of thing. He didn't say that all right there, but that made a big impression on me. And so throughout my life, I was determined I wasn't going to get up and bear my testimony unless I really meant it. And I was one of those people who didn't get answers to prayers for some reason. that God never told me the Book of Mormon was true, or a couple of times in my life I thought maybe I had a testimony the church was true, but that was like two occasions in 34 years, you know. One was at girls' camp, one was in a BYU student ward, and other than that, it was really fleeting. I couldn't get that back. I tried really hard. So, but I was an honest person, and so the truth mattered to me. I wasn't going to pretend anything. Anyway, so where do I go from there? What was it? Oh, when Grant stopped believing, he didn't tell me that he didn't believe. So I don't know if he made that clear or not. He was very much a closet apostate. And I figured he was just a very liberal Mormon. It kind of concerned me. He believed in things like evolution. And he would read books on science, you know. He got the Book of the Month Club, you know, books like Darwin's Dangerous Idea, Demon-Haunted World. I mean, it was kind of scary. I didn't open those books, but I knew that he was reading them. So I was a little concerned, but, you know, it was his reading material. So some things that I noticed that went on in the years, well, now I know that he had stopped believing. He gave me a lot of emotional support. He was always emphasizing how much he loved me and the kids and how important the family was to him. And he was also a very helpful husband, and really very different than my father was in terms of, my dad was a helpful person, but he was very much in charge, and we had very much the roles of the man and the woman in the home. And Grant was more of a feminist, and so I think what happened there is it kind of, it helped me gain strength as a person and not stick me in the woman's role of you're supposed to do the laundry and that sort of stuff. So I think that it was empowering to me. He mentioned the de-wissification of Brenda Project. We joked about that all the time. He was always cheering me on anytime I could lose my temper at somebody, which wasn't very often. It took a lot for me to get mad at people. But if I did, you know, it was deserved, I can guarantee. And he was always egging me on to get me to speak out when I needed to. And that was actually probably a pivotal point for me as far as leaving the church goes, because this person that he was talking about that I had an issue with was just a couple of houses away from us, was in the ward. For some reason, we were always put in callings together. Whether it was, you know, if I was playing the piano in Relief Society, she was the director. If I was the homemaking counselor, they put her on the homemaking committee. And I was just like, oh, can't we get away from this lady? But so I knew that by bringing up a conflict with her, that it was going to get around, and I felt like I was going to be open for judgment. But there just came a point where I realized, you know what? I don't care anymore. I don't care what anybody thinks. I've had it. If I alienate this person, I hope I alienate this person, because I really don't want to be around them anymore. And I think that was a really important thing for me, because later on, we actually moved away from there to get away from these people, because they were really taking over our lives, and their kids were a problem. But anyway, it taught me that the most important thing was to take care of where I needed to be and to be in control of my own life. And if that made somebody else upset, if that made somebody not like me, if that made somebody judge me, that was okay, because I realized how much better it felt to be in control of my own life and not to have it have somebody else running roughshod over me all the time and dumping their garbage on me. So that was very, very important for me. He talked about the guilt. I will add that it did irritate me when he mocked the guilt, because I really did feel that the guilt was part of what made you a good person. That if you felt horrible enough about who you were, if you made a mistake, that somehow you could become a better person. It's a silly thing looking at it now, because taking away that, I was able to find out that you actually have more power when you respect yourself, and beating yourself up over mistakes doesn't help. And I should add, too, that this was guilt over really stupid things, okay? extremely stupid things that shouldn't have even been an issue. One last thing I just want to mention. He did talk to me about science, things like evolution that I hadn't previously believed in. He explained how things worked. He attacked the Noah story, which I think he was really careful. He never attacked Mormonism directly. He would talk about the Bible as myth. He would talk about how the Noah story was impossible because of all the species on the planet, and there's no possible way they could all fit on the boat because there's millions of species, and what would have happened to the fish if the ocean was desalinization, whatever. If you had all that rainwater going to the ocean, all that kind of stuff, how it would kill the fish too, and how it just wouldn't work. And so he didn't attack Mormonism. But, you know, if you take away the Bible, Mormonism is a literal interpretation of the Bible. It does eat at the foundation. Another thing, too, I think one of the biggest things that he did was make me question the value of taking little children to church. I had three young children. Oldest was like 4 or 5, an infant. And we got nothing out of church. We would go to sacrament meeting, fuss with the kids the whole time, or I'd be out nursing and that sort of thing. And then they called me to the nursery. So I'm nursing in the nursery, so I'm spending all the time at church chasing kids around in a dress, and come home exhausted, frustrated, ready to cry half the time, mad at the kids, and he's saying, well, why would God want this to happen? What are these kids getting out of church anyway? The meetings aren't geared for them anyway. And I really started questioning that. And I'd go to my LDS family and I'd say, well, why do you think we take kids to church? And they're talking about obedience. We're going to train these kids to go to church no matter what. We're creating habits. And I'm going, this is stupid. So eventually, I'm at a low point spiritually, and somebody asked me to bear my testimony in church, and which was a really bad mistake. And I had the night to think about it. It was the next day, and I thought and thought and thought about what I could say that would be the truth, because I wasn't going to just get up there and say, I know the church is true, you know. And I couldn't think of anything I could say, and so that's when I went to him and said, you know, I don't think I have a testimony. And so that was the spark I needed to get out, and we started studying and working on it together. But I think it just helped to have somebody to help guide me along in those ways. But I always felt like it was my own idea. I never felt like he tried to get me out of the church. It felt like it came from me. It was my life experiences and recognizing that the church didn't make sense. It didn't explain my life. It didn't explain why things happened. It didn't give me the blessings that were promised. My prayers weren't answered. All these things came together and showed me that I needed to look at something else. So anyway, I think that's it. So.
Following the man goes out first theme. I was different in my approach. How many of you have seen Monty Python's Quest for the Holy Grail? Okay. I'm sure you recall the scene where Lancelot is in the distance running towards the castle and suddenly just rushes in and starts killing everyone, you know, slashing and killing. And that I felt like Lancelot when I left the church. And
that's the approach to life.
My story, my exit and getting out of Mormonism is a study in inquisitive nature combined with a healthy dose of being retarded. because throughout my life, I in my studies from pretty much from high school on in studying science and trying to understand the world around me, making inquiries, things just weren't matching up. But because I believe Mormonism to be what it was, I had this amazing ability to put all those things behind me. Once in high school, approaching my father saying, what about the dinosaurs? I can clearly see that the dinosaurs were here. This is a real part of the earth. And of course, my father told me the old Mormon line that they're just from other worlds, and that's how they came to be. And I remember thinking at the time, that's just absurd. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. So that kind of thinking led me into my mission. I too, ich war auch deutsche Missionar. So something about the German missionaries, I don't know, there's a lot of us that leave. Because we have to deal with those hard-headed Germans, you know. But there's a saying, you can always tell a German, but you can't tell them much. So anyway, Melanie says that goes for Swedes too. So. but during my mission, was confronted with things. I had a good companion of mine show me about Adam God and wanted to know my opinion on that. I'd never heard of it before. That was just one in a long line of dominoes. In my callings throughout the church, I was always in a teaching position. I was gospel doctrine teacher twice, young men's president, always doing these teachings, always preparing lessons. And because I took my calling seriously, really wanted to know what this church was all about to its core, to its depth, and always finding things out that I was never taught before. And of course, the apologists would blame me, because of course I should have known this all along. The information was always there, so how foolish of me for not knowing that. But so as everything came along, I would continually have these horrific discoveries. And I never told Melanie on our honeymoon, of all things. We were down at my grandparents' house in St. George, staying there. Yes, it was hot in St. George, figuratively, literally. Yeah, so, so yeah, you like it. And so, but I prior to my mission, I found out my grandfather, my Mormon grandfather, was an atheist, and so consequently, some of the reading material that he had there on his bookshelves in St. George, there was the Mormon murders. And I wanted to do some reading on and kind of take a break there. And took down the book and began to read. So, it's a hot testimony. So, so anyway, began to read about the Mormon murders, Mark Hoffman, and here we are 4 days out of a temple marriage, and I'm discovering these things, and just, you know, my world is being turned upside down once again, and that's basically how our whole married life had been up till March of 2006, when I finally came to my wife and I said, it's a fraud, and I'm not going back, I'm resigning. And that's it. Again, I'm going to embarrass Ken Clark because I love him. I think he's marvelous. it was we had our fifth child, and he's a son. And I had decided at that point, because it was going to be another boy in my family, that as a father, I owed it to him if I was going to send him on a mission and put him through the rigors of priesthood and all of these things, that he needed to be able to turn to me if with any question and say, Dad, is this true? And I would be able to answer to him, absolutely, son, it's true. I've done my research. It's real. And I was in serious doubt stage throughout his pregnancy and so forth, Melanie's pregnancy with her son. And finally one night, Melanie was in bed. I took our son downstairs with me and laid him there in his little chair and just looked at him. And I thought, tonight is the night I am going to put all of these doubts to rest. I'm going to go out and I'm going to research everything I can. and no stone will be left unturned. And it was that determination, as I looked at him there, laying there, I thought, it's for his sake and mine, because I'm tired of the roller coaster. But for their sake, I have to find out if this is really true. Where are all these doubts leading me? And for the first time ever, I Googled in. Google is a very good God. I believe in the Google God, by the way. The Google Stone. You know, Joseph had his Seer Stone. I had the Google Stone, so works very well. Mine was far more accurate. You know, Joseph never found any treasures. I did. So, anyhow. I Googled in former Mormon, and Ken Clark's story came up. And those of you that know Ken Clark, being a former institute director and going through that whole rigmarole, his story really spoke to me because he was an inquisitive man, wanted to know the truth, took it seriously, and it led him out of the church. And as I pondered his story throughout the night, it resonated with me so powerfully because I just thought, this is an educated man. This is a man that took it as seriously as I do, and yet has made the conclusion that Mormonism just can't be what it claims. And as the sun was coming up, Melanie came down the stairs and said, you know, you haven't been to bed, what's going on? And I turned to her and I said, what if it's all a crock? And of course she screamed, you haven't been reading your Book of Mormon. You haven't been praying. You've been looking at porn. That just goes with the sexual theme of the talk. So, so anyway, it was at that point that I just continued on my whirlwind, 15-hour a day, kind of the Bob McHugh deal, 15 hours a day for 3 weeks straight where no stone was left unturned. And as Mike said yesterday in a movie screening we watched, the peace that comes when you know that you're not crazy, you're not insane, that these people have been lying to me my whole life, and I was putting myself through hell feeling bad because I didn't have enough faith to make all those puzzle pieces fit. And no matter how hard I, you know, you remember that toy when you were a child and you could hammer with a little hammer into the different shapes. I was always trying to put that square peg into a round hole. And everyone else around me seemed to be able to make it work. But retard Chad just couldn't make it happen. So it was from that point, just being very direct, I approached Melanie about it and I told her, I said, you know, this, it just can't continue. I'm taking off my garments. I will be sending a letter to my family and I will let the children know. At first she said, you know, let's try to keep this under wraps and whatnot. And she didn't get too crazy on me. I was surprised. There was no standing over me with a knife at night while I slept. No blood atonement on her mind at all. So, that I know of. There's more to come, folks. The story's going to get better. So, there we have it. That's my story out, and I'll let Melanie take it from here.
Well, just to give a little background on me, a little bit where I'm coming from and my upbringing in the church. Of course, my parents were married in the temple, but I lost my father when I was 13 years old, and as he was a very, very big influence on my life. He was my best friend. And so to lose him at that age, and I never was that close to my mother, and I couldn't seem to reach out to her, so the church was my lifeline. My young women's teachers and all of that, they were my support, my lifeline, so the church was very important to me. Now, as Chad would go through some of these discoveries, you know, he thought he was really quiet about it, but... And he was quiet about it. But looking back, I can pinpoint in our marriage each of those discoveries because of the way he acted after. He would withdraw into himself. He would become depressed. He wouldn't want to go to church. He wouldn't want to do his. He was just rebellious, which of course is the Molly Mormon that I was very concerning, because you know, this was our salvation on the line here, and why aren't you toeing the line here, buddy? So when he came to me that morning, what if it's a crock? Of course, yes, I did cry and scream and cry and cry some more, and it was 3 weeks of sheer hell for me. But at the same time, I saw Chad go through a process. I saw Chad become a better person. I saw Chad let go of those priesthood binds that were holding him and I down. And he would turn to me and say, "You and the kids are the most important thing to me, and I love you, and I love the kids, and I only want to do what's right by you." And it was that love and that constant confirmation that he was giving me, even as he was badgering me with, you know, yeah, Sir Lancelot, yeah. But it was that constant confirmation that we were the most important thing. Not his pride, not his priesthood, not the church, not anything else but us. We were his prime focus. And I could see that in him, and I could see the change in him, that he was becoming a better person, and it was that that made me think, you know, I've known and I've loved this man for 13 years at the time. And I know he's studious, and I know that he's smart, and I know that he's honest. I know these things about him, so there's got to be something to what he's saying. This was all in the back of my mind, and there were other days that I go, okay, this would just be so much easier if something bad happened to him. That I wouldn't have to deal with it. Is that sick or what? But that's what you're programmed for. It'd be so much easier if I didn't have to deal with this. But that's the point, is that he made me deal with it. He was there every day. What about this? Honey, what about this? What about that? What about this? What do you think about this? And he would do a little bit at a time, but, you know, there were some times I was like, you know, I can't listen to this anymore. I can't listen to this anymore. But he started reading to me a little bit from Arza Evans' book. Thank you, Arza. And it was little snippets here and there from Arza's book. And I remember one night, well, let me go back before I go to this, about the kids. I didn't want him to tell the kids, of course. And he was adamant about being honest about what he felt and what he believed with our children. So he would sit down with them, and he was very respectful of me also and my beliefs, and said, "Okay, kids, I've been doing some research, and this is what I believe. And I know that's not what your mom believes, and she can tell you what she believes, and then you can decide what you think." And he would tell me, you know, "I want the kids to stay home every other week." Well, you can imagine how long that lasted. Let's see. Let's stay home with Dad, or let's go to church with Mom. Go figure. That lasted about, what, 3-4 weeks? But it was also looking at my children and thinking, you know, I've got to figure this out one way or the other, because they are at stake here. But he forced me to look at this. He forced me. It was make a choice. Make a choice. I'm not going away. I'm not being quiet. Even though that's exactly what I wanted him to do. I wanted him to be quiet, because that's how I always dealt with things, the passive-aggressive way. Because that's how I was taught. You don't talk. I needed a de-wussification too. Still going through that.
Oh, I wish you'd go back.
Sorry, doesn't work that way.
That's a lie. He really doesn't. But going back to one night, we were reading, I think, was it from Arza's book? Yeah, it was from Arza's book, and he was reading to me about Brigham Young sending members out as part of the Mormon battalion, and how he first went to the army, or the government said, "Please, take 200 of our men." 1,000, and only 200 went. Whatever.
See? You just get her back the old way.
Anyway, as he's telling me this story, and he's reading out of here and saying, okay, you know, Brigham Young, and they sent these men out away from their families, and the government was compensating them. But that money was not going to these families. That money was going to the church. And I remember sitting at the sink, and I was washing dishes, and I just got tears in my eyes, and I said, a prophet of God should not do that. A prophet of God should not do that. That is wrong. And it was at that point that I really started doing my own research. And I think this is a period of, what, 2.5 months? And one day he says, I was going down shopping to the Gateway, and I said, oh, we should have stopped at Victoria's Secret to get me some new underwear. Which shocked him.
The garments were but
that's our story. He loved me through it, but he wasn't quiet about it either. And for me, that's what worked.
Okay, I'm going to be quick, since these guys are too talkative anyway. And I don't think much of the priesthood, so I'm going to go first. What is with the feedback? Okay, is that better? Okay. I am the female equivalent of Grant down on the other end, and I left the church first, so that's why I'm going first here today. Our experience, I'll give you just a little tiny bit of background. I'm trying to take only about 10 minutes here. I also come from a very, very strong Mormon background. I come from the Johnson family line, the Delsina Elmira ones that slept with Joseph Smith. That's the line that I came from. And so consequently, I was raised in a very immersed Mormon environment. I'm the 7th of 9 children, and my father is a patriarch, and my mother passed away 2 years ago, but up until that time, they'd been on 2 missions and just extremely strict Mormon environment. In fact, when I was growing up, I was not allowed to have non-Mormon friends unless my mother had met their parents and gone to their home. I can remember when I was in 4th grade, my mom, I had this best friend that was Baptist, and I wanted to have a sleepover so badly, and my mom said, I'll go and meet her mother at their home to make sure there's no alcohol or anything in their home that would be a bad influence on you. I was the 7th, and so by this time, my parents had figured it out, according to them. Very, very good people. I love my parents dearly, but I was a natural-born skeptic. Just like Grant, I can remember when I was very young, 12, 13 years old, I would make fun of people in testimony meeting, you know, and we had prayer. We would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and have family prayer and individual prayer and blessing over the food and very, very rigorous, structured environment. And I would ask my mom questions all the time. I was not quiet about it. When I was 16 years old, my mother was the seminary teacher, and we split the classes, and I began teaching seminary, very doctrinally oriented. I wanted to know the questions. I didn't really care about Joseph Smith. I wanted all the little details. I didn't care about Jesus. I wanted to know all the details. I would ask questions like, If he's half God and half man, does he have to be transfigured in order to talk to his father? You know, silly little questions like this. And I would drive my mother insane. And I would ask these questions to my elder brother. And we would talk for hours. It's silly little things like, how does revelation work? I don't get it. If God's perfect and God's talking to man and man is imperfect, then how can his message come through an imperfect filter and still remain perfect? These were questions that I asked when I was 15, 16 years old. Consequently, my mother sent me on a youth mission, or I decided to go on a youth mission when I was about 16 years old. And I spent a summer going on a youth mission in the middle of the Indian Reservation in Arizona. And I had a wonderful time. And I just loved that summer, that missionary experience. And I came back, and my mother seemed very gratified that I'd finally gotten with the system and decided that I was going to act like I was a believing member. I went away to BYU, where I met Jeff. We got married when I was barely 20. Jeff was 26. The same old BYU story that you have seen over and over again. We dated for about, well, I wouldn't even call it dating, about 5 weeks. We had a 5-week engagement. And so I can remember looking across the altar at the temple in Los Angeles, thinking, who is this person that I'm marrying? I mean, I really didn't know him. I'd only known him for 3 months. Looking back, it is an absolute miracle that we have been able to last as long as we have. But he's a good one, so I'm keeping him. We were very active. I have perfectionist tendencies. I was going to make it to the celestial kingdom. I didn't care. Again, I didn't really care about all the details. I was going to make it to the celestial kingdom, and so I had my little laundry list of things that I needed to do, and I started having children. I had 4 children in the first 6 years of our marriage, and they were these little tidy things, and I started teaching them the articles of faith, and I put them all to wrap so that the kids could memorize the articles of faith. And we were super, super active. Jeff was young men's president. I was young women's president. And this is when we had a very small family. And we were in Salt Lake City at the time, in the middle of Salt Lake City. And we had such an inactivity problem in our ward that Jeff and I, on any occasion, had at least 3 callings, not minor callings. I was in the state primary presidency. I was in the Relief Society presidency at the same time, concurrently, and with these small children. And so I totally understand when they're talking about Sundays not being a fun thing. And I spent several years Sundays were miserable. And I would come home, and Jeff would come home, and we'd say, you know, we're supposed to be getting something out of church. Isn't this supposed to be a spiritual feed? Instead, I felt like we were giving, and not getting anything from it. I'm going to back up for a second. When we were at BYU, I met Jeff, and he was minoring in philosophy at the time. And so my strategy was to take a philosophy class so that I could get to know him better. So I began taking philosophy and discovered I had an absolute love for it. It was simply the way that I had been looking at life, always, you know, with this skeptical mind. And so we would talk philosophy for the first 5, 10, 15, 20 years of our married life now. My time is up. All right, who's running the show? And I became agnostic in looking at these more broad philosophy questions way before I ever lost my belief in Mormonism, if that makes any sense at all. And I went a good 5 years agnostic. And before I ever started studying Mormon doctrine and Mormon history to the extent that I did. And when I did, it all made sense to me. You know, I studied Joseph Smith, and I said, well, this is a man acting like a man. And that was my approach to it. And I didn't have a whole lot of anger. It just made absolute sense to me. During this time, I was, Jeff and I were moving right along, very, very busy, very, very worn out from the very Mormon lifestyle that we were living. And we would argue about some things. We'd argue about some things. A lot of the time, we were arguing about children. I was growing increasingly farther away from the church, or increasingly more liberal. Even as I was teaching Relief Society, I was very liberal in my approach. I never bore my testimony. This went on for 10 years. I was very active as an agnostic because we were still part of the Mormon family. I knew going into the marriage that Jeff was Jeff and I was I, and I didn't try to push anything on him. I figured he is his own person, and he's entitled to his own beliefs, and we would maintain constant dialogue about the bigger, broader questions, the nature of God, the nature and purpose of life, things like that. So I never really went to war with him about Mormon doctrine at all. And so I, looking back, I was really glad that I did that, because I think that it alleviated a lot of potential tension in the marriage. And I have been online for about 15 years now on Mormon boards, and I have seen hundreds, literally hundreds of marriages that have gone by the wayside because one has lost their belief and the other one is seemingly incapable of doing so. And I can recall multiple times in my marriage where Jeff and I would be having a spat about something, and I felt like I was weighing the value of the marriage and the value of Jeff with my need to make sure that we were on the same page with things. And this became more of an issue as our children started getting older. And I didn't really want my daughters to go into young women. I didn't feel it was a healthy environment. I was a feminist. I still am a feminist. And I'm very vocal about my desire for my daughters to chase their dreams and not have their identity defined by their gender. And so this is something that went back and forth. And I would take a look and I would weigh the value. And with my parents and my family, I have done the same thing to a secondary extent, where I have said, okay, I was raised Mormon. I was raised very, very Mormon, where my identity and the religion were completely intertwined. And so when I deal with Mormons to this day, I look at them, and I have a natural respect for everyone's belief to believe in whatever they want. And I'll take a look at them, and I'll determine whether or not they're capable of listening to some of my questions or my comments or my stance, and still be able to handle it. My mother passed away, like I said, 2 years ago, and she was so entrenched that I had absolutely no desire to share my viewpoint with her, because I knew that it would cause more harm than good. And I think that this is being played out everywhere, and to a very great extent in marriages, when you decide, okay, I don't believe this anymore. I'm going to take a look at my spouse and say, okay, where are they at? How much do I love them? How much have I invested in the marriage? How much time am I going to put focusing on them so that we can get on the same page, as opposed to someone who is simply incapable? And there are Mormon people who are simply incapable of pulling away from the religion without an enormous amount of injury and harm to themselves. I believe that. I probably, some of you don't, but I do, and it is an agnostic stance. I don't think that the church is fraudulent per se. I just think it was Joseph Smith trying to do the best with what he had, with a real high libido, and it makes perfect sense to me. So I wasn't too angry, and this was a process for Jeff and I that lasted a long time. And whenever people ask me, how do you keep your marriage as one of you is losing the belief system and the other one is in, I tell them, have a lot of patience, and have a lot of love, and don't badger them with details. Don't badger them with details, because ultimately they're irrelevant. When you're looking at the relationship is the most important thing. I think that I've gone over my 10 minutes. I'm going to move on to Jeff.
Thank you. Just a little history on myself. I'm from a part member family. My mom was LDS. My dad, he says he's NFL. And that's kind of how I was raised. I, unlike Grant, I believed in Santa Claus, and I was self-centered. I even believed that God put all my friends on the earth so I could have fun. So I was a believing person at a young age. My life is, I've always been a believer in a God, and when I went on a mission, served it well. I was very devoted to that system. I believed in Jesus Christ. I had that, went through the whole thing, and I served it very well. I was very devoted and did what I was supposed to. Went to BYU, got married to Chris. She talks about how across from the altar she was wondering who she's marrying, and all I'm thinking about is I'm getting sex tonight. So, no, I'm a man. I just think that way. Sorry. I did get into philosophy quite a bit, and to be objective, I'm surprised at how well I could discount being objective to my religion. I was always subjective. When it came to the church criticism, I'd always find something to, like the apologist, I'd look for something. It's amazing that you can be educated and that you can block out that kind of stuff and not be objective about it. Chris, as we were driving up here, she was mentioning about, do you remember a time we were discussing this in bed, and I told her, I only know sports, sex, and finance. And if it's not those subjects, I don't remember anything we're talking about. So I'm very shallow on that. So that's why I told her she gets the bulk of the talk about what. Me, it's just, I knew Chris was starting to fade away. It really didn't bother me. I allowed that. I just didn't think, I didn't like taking the kids to church anyways. It was miserable. That was very challenging. But I still believed. And I guess how I had an epiphany, kind of like Grant in a way, I was starting to think, I deal with finance. I deal with, things that are concrete. And if something doesn't work, you move away from it to something else. And I thought, let's see, I've had about 20,000 prayers in my life, and how many of them have been answered? And I thought, maybe one. Now, if you're, I'm a manager, a finance person, and when something doesn't work, you move away from it, move to something else. Well, 20,000, one out of 20,000, usually you would have quit after about one out of 10. So I figured, something's not working here. And I know Chris had all these books, and I wasn't the kind of person that I wouldn't read an anti any kind of book. I wanted objectivity. So I did read, like, Grant Palmer's book, and then I read some others, and I wanted it to be by people that were really legitimate, and they were, or they're believers, or at least they were objective. And so that's kind of where I went. I started going, I questioned the prayer thing, I questioned some other things, and I decided to be more objective because I was objective about everything else. So that kind of led me to the belief that, this is just like any other religion. And there's no more foundation to it than all the others. And that's kind of, in a short version, that's where we're at.
I was going to say, I left first, and I don't know how many circumstances there are where the female leaves before the man. I think it's not nearly as common as the other way around. But I would often, when Jeff and I would argue about something of the sort, I would absolutely default to sex as a way of ending an argument. And it served multiple purposes. It really did. And I'm very grateful for the fact that we're able to find these common things that we enjoy that we're able to focus on in our marriage.
I think we ought to abandon ship on this. Will this work out in the audience? Give it a. Okay. Well, I had penned down some questions, but first let's default to the audience. Is there any questions for the individuals or for the panel themselves that came up you'd like to address? No? I guess you've done it all. Go ahead.
Have any of you had children where the children are split, where half the siblings are in the church and half the siblings are out? Older children that in their teens.
All our kids are young. They were delighted to leave the church, so no problem here.
Yeah, our oldest is 12, and he's thrilled.
This was an issue for us, the fact that our children were becoming teens, and we live in Utah County, and very, very high concentration of Mormon up in Cedar Hills. And so we have one daughter that her social structure is in the church. They're Mormon. And I had concerns, always concerns, about my children and their socialization as we were drifting away from the church. In fact, I wanted to move from Utah so that they could get a support system that was not Mormon. She is a senior right now in high school, and luckily all of my children have been able to find more liberal Mormon friends. All of their friends are Mormon. But they've been able to find more liberal friends, and my children at this point have been raised by me, and they are very, very open-minded, and we've taught them to be respectful of all religions, all beliefs of people, and so that's helped them understand. That is the extent that we've had trying to deal with children who were not sure where to go with their socialization, who to date, who to hang out with, those types of things.
One question I'd like to interject is, you, at some point you'll have to tell your parents, particularly if they're believers, they're usually going to say, it's his fault you left, it's your fault he left. Do you then approach them as a united front, or is it better to go as an individual to your parents to explain why you're leaving the church? Has that been an issue?
Well, we just split it up. My wife handled her side of the family. I handled my side of the family. It was hard. It really was. And it continues to be a problem to this day. And it's particularly difficult. Yeah, for my side of the family. It's particularly difficult because I had a very close relationship with my mother. I mean, she's a saint. She's just an absolutely wonderful person. I mean, there's points in the last couple of years where she's swearing at me. I've never heard her say a swear word in my life. And it's been difficult, but I think they're coming around. So not much I can do about it.
I think to begin with, well, of course, Chad told his family first because he left first, and that went over really well. And they, of course, right then turned to me with, you know, their support and their love, and in front of him, we will support you and love you and do whatever we can to help you. In other words, please don't leave. You are our only hope to get him back. So when I did leave, we are now a united front. And I guess I dealt with my family on my own, but as far as an issue, I mean, you can't have too many issues with people who just don't get you or don't want to.
How did you deal with the idea that it's his fault he left? How did you answer that?
Gosh. Well, yeah, why I left. Right. Yeah, his mom turned to me one day and said, well, I think that the real reason Chad is leaving is so that he can get out of the marriage. And yeah, okay, that reflects greatly upon your son and myself also. That, thank you very much. But the cognitive dissonance there is incredible. And of course they do blame him, and my family blames him as well. My stepfather came to me one day and said, even though I'd written them letters and said, this is why I left, not because Chad told me to, not because I'm being brainwashed by him, or because I just, you know, I'm too afraid to get out of my marriage, that's not it. He did come to me one day and say, we know why Chad left, why did you leave? And I just looked at him and went, are you kidding me? I told you this. Have you read anything? Well, no. No, we didn't want to read any of that. We think it's just because it would be too hard for you to leave with five kids and be a single mom. That's what made them feel better.
Any other questions from the audience?
Yeah. Now that you're out, do you ever go back to church for family events, baptisms, and stuff like that? Like, for example, my wife, when she got called to the choir director, I go with her and support her, sing in the choir, and every time the choir goes to church or sings in church, I go to church that week. But I think that's a good thing, but I see people both inside and outside that think that's a bad thing. So. Sorry, should I repeat it, or...?
Speaking for myself, they actually gave me assignments to get me to go back. I'm a musician, and so lots of people needed to be accompanied and that sort of thing. But we do get invited to lots of baby blessings, those sorts of things, and we generally avoid going. We've gone to some, but it was, frankly, kind of irritating, you know, because you go and you have to listen to the testimonies and be polite, and it's really hard after a while. I mean, we did it more when we first left. We've been out for over 8 years. It wasn't a pleasant experience, and a lot of times there would be the family gathering afterwards. So we kind of ditch out on the meeting and go to the luncheon afterwards a lot of times. We've been to one baptism, I think, and my mom said something in her talk about people, parents in Zion who don't teach their children to be baptized when 8 years of old. And I sat there thinking, should I get up and walk out, or should I just sit here? Because I really don't know if that was a deliberate attempt to preach to me when I couldn't say something, or if that was just something, a standard baptism talk. So I think we kind of try and avoid those things if we can. We don't go. We had gone to some weddings and stood outside, I think, at the beginning, but now if somebody's having a wedding, we don't go to the temple to be in the pictures afterwards. We just go to the reception, and that's kind of how we've handled it. But on the other flip side of it, when we were married, we had a really great aunt that hasn't been in the church for years, and she showed up and supported us at the temple and stuff, and she's just a sweetheart. So I don't think it's wrong to go. I just think in my position, I don't feel like I want to take the second-class citizen role and stand outside or wait in a lobby. So that's just, I don't think there's a right or a wrong on this one.
I have an enormous family, and the only time we get together are for church events, like baby blessings and baptisms and weddings. And for about 5 years, after I was agnostic, I would go in, and I had a temple recommend. I would go into the stake president, who was a friend of mine, and I would tell him, you know what, I really don't believe. I'd like to believe, but I don't believe. And so I had a temple recommend, and I went in. I went to several of my nieces and nephews' weddings in that stance. To your question, I think it just depends on you. I've seen some people who they look at the ward or family church structure, and they see some value in it, and they see a value in supporting the spouse in that way. They don't really care. The people who I know who tend to be able to do that are agnostics. Those who have moved on to another a religion have a more difficult time doing that. But I've seen plenty of people who have done it and have done it for years. And it's kind of interesting. After I lost my belief, and I bet Jeff did the same thing, we'd go to church and we'd keep an eye out for the people who kind of sat in the back and they're kind of quiet and they don't make any comments. You try to identify those people who you think are closet non-believers that are there just filling the seats. And they make really interesting comments in the classes, like the Sunday school gospel doctrine classes. So either way, I think it just depends on you. You have to test. I discovered that with me, the longer I was active as an unbeliever, the more irritated I got in the meetings. You know, someone would say something really weird and bizarre or really dogmatic, and it would just drive me nuts. And so, you know, after a certain amount of time, for my mental health, I needed to stay away. But you got to take it on a case-by-case basis.
Did any of you have siblings or maybe nieces or nephews on missions when you left the church? And how did you go about having them told, or were they told? I have a brother on a mission right now, and my family hasn't told him, and I kind of want to tell him just because I want him to start planting seeds or something like that. But anyways, any siblings on missions?
I'm not the one to talk to, because I refused to tell my mother that I was an unbeliever, because I thought it would cause her so much harm that I said, I'm just going to wait until she dies. And I did. I mean, you know, the same with my father. I've not told him. They know that I am super liberal. They know that I am not active, but they do not know the extent of my unbelief. I do have multiple nieces and nephews that are. I have one niece who is on a mission right now that sends these glowing emails out to the family and talks about the missionary work and things like that. I think it's important to support them as they're a family member, but I don't think it's important to support what they're doing. And so, you know, that's been my experience with it.
I've got about, between Brenda and I, we've got about 130 close relatives, so there will never be a time we don't have somebody on a mission. They're all members of the church. And we have, right now, we have a niece in Colorado Springs, and she sends us these just, you know, uber TBM, you know, mission stories. And that was the last big blow up I had with my mom. She was relating how, you know, somebody got baptized because of my niece's efforts, and I'm going, geez, I feel bad for him. But you know, we tell him, we try to be as open as we can. That's the kind of thing, you know, leaving the church, we were very good members of the church, and frankly, maybe I'm being kind of arrogant, but I think our nieces and nephews really like us, you know. And so, you know, that us leaving the church is not something that we'd be able to keep quiet anyway. So, you know, everybody knows we've left, and some of them have started leaving themselves. So we're very proud of them, and I think I'm kind of hoping that we're having a little bit of influence that way.
I'd like to target a specific point in your lives where you are not on the same page, because that's, you know, for the foreseeable future, that's where I'll be with my estranged spouse. I'd like to hear some of your approaches to teaching your children to basically teach them about planet Earth, you know, help them come out of planet Utah, while still helping them maintain respect for the spouse that believes, but helping them just get some enlightenment, helping them to grow up.
When I left, I was very direct with my children. I sat them down and I told them specifically why I did not believe in Mormonism. I told them that I believed Joseph Smith was a liar and that the Book of Mormon was not true. I was that direct with them. I don't think you need to coddle kids at all. Kids are intelligent. We try to think that they don't get it, but they do. They understand what's going on. My daughter was 7 at the time, and she came right to me and she said, "Well, Dad, who's going to baptize me?" And I said, "Well, nobody, honey. I'm not baptizing, and you're going to have to wait till you're 18 until you can make that decision yourself." I did that because I was the lone man in the middle of the whirlwind. And they had to hear exactly where I was at. I was never going to hide anything from them. I was going to be completely direct with them. And it really helped them to understand exactly what was going on. The kids, Melanie was at church. She was in the young women's presidency. And I was in the shower with my, let's see, how old was she, three, my little daughter, Rachel. And I'm washing her hair in the shower, and she turns to me and she says, "Dad, we've got to rescue Mom from the church." So, you got to be direct. You got to be honest with them. Those little hearts are just, they're open, you know, they're listening. And I think we have this feeling that when we leave the church that we're going to hurt our kids, we're going to hurt our spouse. I think in the long term we do far more harm in holding things back and not being open and direct with who we are. I mean, my God, we have gone through hell to get out of Mormonism, to be honest and to be ourselves. If with our children and our spouse we can't be that, what kind of life is that still? I mean, it's not worth the price that we've paid to be quiet. I mean, obviously do it with respect and love, but do it in a way that you're open and honest. Kids deserve it.
I kind of took a different tactic, and I started teaching my children comparative religion. Rather than, badger with the details about Mormonism, I would make a comparison to Buddhism or Taoism or something of that sort. And then you're talking on a language that everyone can talk about without being defensive. And I felt that it was very helpful.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was there another comment? Go ahead.
Kind of going along with what Chris says, I think it's important to open their eyes to other things, not just maybe talk about Mormonism, but open up their eyes about science, explain things to them in terms that they will understand, that if when they go back to the Mormon regime of your spouse, that they can look at things more objectively, so maybe later on in their lives they're more able to make coherent decisions.
I was just going to say on that one, kind of the indirect approach of teaching, like what Melanie said, with the teaching them critical thinking skills. Carl Sagan's book, Demon Haunted World, has some great ideas on developing your BS detector. And do they? Yeah, they.
We'd like to come up
they
with
should.
Demon Haunted Ward. That's going to be the next.
So I think that that could be a way where maybe you, instead of getting in a fight with your spouse about the details of Mormonism, that maybe you could just take it out of the realm of Mormonism altogether and just say, okay, like when the gentleman was talking about praying 20,000 times to get an answer once, that was effective for me, because I prayed a ton and I didn't get answers. And when I read Demon Haunted World, he talked about reproducible results, and I'm going, I have a reproducible result. I can read the Book of Mormon as many times as I want and pray about it. I'm not going to get an answer. And I think when they learn to respect those things instead of questioning themselves and thinking they're doing something wrong and they should feel guilty and worthless, then they should maybe look at the whole process and realize maybe the process is flawed. So if you can fix the process, maybe you can get around criticizing the church directly.
We have about 5 minutes. Any
I have some very young children. I mean, they're 7 and 5. And my grandparents are, I mean, their grandparents, my parents, are very true Mormon TBM. And every time they go over there, it's like they're getting brainwashed. I mean, I hate to say it, but it really feels that way. And how do I set those boundaries and say, you know, you can't, you know, I don't mind if you teach them good morals, but you need to, you know, let me raise my own children. I mean, how would you handle that? Have you handled that with your own children? Have you had problems with other people trying to take your children back into that environment?
Here I go again. I'll clarify. I'm known as an asshole in my family. I wear the title well, the big A. Recently over the summer, my parents, my children, we were sitting at breakfast, and they said, well, we were over at Grandma and Grandpa's, and they made us fold our arms and bow our heads and say a prayer, and we really didn't want to do that. And we let the children decide whatever they want to do on that. If they want to pray, they want to believe in God, whatever. We're not ramming it down their throats about that. That's their own decisions. But I asked them, I said, well, did that make you feel uncomfortable? And they said, yeah, we really just didn't want to participate. So I sent an email to my parents, and I said, you know, I understand that you, I know that you pray as part of your tradition over the food and whatnot. I said, but we in our home afford, you know, give our children the ability to make that decision themselves and not be forced into do it. And if you want to pray to Elohim and friends, that's okay. But we don't force our kids to do it here. And we
wonder why he has that time.
Well, but we would hope that you would respect that for them, let them make their own decisions. I think, again, it goes back to communication. We are such retarded communicators as Mormons. We all just put on the smiles and we got to learn to talk. And that's what's so important when we leave the church, especially with our Mormon family, is just to be loving and say, this is our boundaries, and we hope you respect them. Of course, the Mormons won't, so just keep telling them. That's all.
Thank you all. Join me in thanking the board. Yeah.
I just want to give you my personal thanks, too, especially to the Kimballs who came in at the last minute practically to do this. So it's been really, I think, really good information. I really appreciate it. Thank you. We're going to take a little break and make it short. We're going to start right at 1:45, and we're in for a real treat with Ken's presentation. He's told me some things about it, and I think it's going to be just really good. So be back here and in your seats by 1:45.